Welcome to the RVC podcast. My name is Matthias Kleins, and today we will be talking to Professor Katharina Stärk about blue tongue virus, a virus causing a devastating disease in ruminants. In the first two episodes of our series of podcasts on blue tongue, we have learned from Yoav Aluni and Professor Joe Brownlee that blue tongue disease is a non-contagious disease of ruminants, which is caused by a virus that is transmitted between cattle and sheep by insect vectors. If animals become infected after a midge bite, animals show severe respiratory symptoms and lameness, and up to a third of affected animals may die. This complex mechanism by which the disease spreads, involving Culicoides midges as a vector and potential reservoir, means that once the disease is present in a geographic area, it may quickly become endemic. The relationship of virus, midges, and the host animal also adds a level of complexity to the speed at which the disease spreads and to the measures that may be employed to attenuate or prevent this spread. In today's episode, Katharina Stärk, Professor in Veterinary Public Health at the Royal Veterinary College, will tell us how she is helping to improve our understanding of blue tongue epidemiology using methods that could have much wider implications in veterinary public health. Katharina, thank you for coming in today to talk to us about blue tongue. You have been working at the Swiss Federal Veterinary Office on various public health and veterinary health issues, but predominantly also on blue tongue virus disease. Based on your experience in Switzerland, which species of Culicoides midges are actually responsible in the transmission of blue tongue disease in Northern Europe?
When we started to work on blue tongue in Switzerland, we went through quite a steep learning curve because we did not have the background or the experience in entomological research. So we started out actually trapping Culicoides on farms using special midge traps and then analyzed the midges that we caught in order to identify which were the predominant species. We knew that traditionally Culicoides imicola was the one that was expected to be most effective in transmission of blue tongue. So we selected our trapping sites such that they would be in areas where there was a climate that would be suitable for Culicoides imicola to occur. Now, when we analyzed these catches, and these are very high numbers of very tiny midges, you have to put them under the microscope, and it's quite a tedious exercise to actually look at the wings and different anatomical structures of the midges to find out which species you're looking at. And some of the catches, we had more than 70,000 midges to look at. So it was quite a large work. And we found that only one single specimen was actually imicola, and we could only find it once ever and never since.
So that was one which got lost somewhere on the way.
Well, it's quite interesting, actually. There was quite a lot of discussion with experts also here in the UK with the reference lab, and they have a lot of experience, obviously, catching midges all over the world. And they were quite surprised by our catch, and we analyzed all kind of possible hypotheses. We even looked at it was near an airport where we caught it, a tiny little airport in the south of Switzerland, and we analyzed flights that were coming in during the time of the year when we caught it, but we couldn't find any connection. So at the moment it's still a mystery to us why we found this. But the majority of the midges that we caught belong to two groups of Culicoides. One is called the Culicoides obsoletus complex, and it's a number of different subspecies in that complex. And then the second most prevalent species is Culicoides pulicaris, both of which are known to be potentially related to outbreaks in other countries in Europe. However, in Northern Europe, they've also found another type of Culicoides divulfi. We only caught that type in a limited number. So we think that in the case of Switzerland, I mean, it's definitely not the species that is traditionally linked to blue tongue outbreaks, so that is imicola, but other species, and they are very abundant, particularly in Switzerland, but probably also in these other countries that are now affected. And actually Switzerland now also has outbreaks of blue tongue, and that only happened in the last couple of weeks, also in the north of the country, which came as a surprise to us.
So that would mean, based on the abundance of appropriate vectors, blue tongue disease can spread all over Northern Europe, basically.
Yes, I think that's what you have to assume. Once the virus is introduced in a region, there will be vectors present, at least during the warmer months of the year, that can at least to some extent spread the disease.
Does your work also go hand in hand or support the theory that the introduction of blue tongue virus in Northern Europe was not via migration of the vector, but possibly by introduction of diseased animals?
Yes, that would be consistent with what we find also now in Switzerland, because we started vector surveillance because of the development of the dynamics of blue tongue in the Mediterranean countries. First of all, Spain and Portugal got infected, and then Corsica, and then it got into Italy as well. So our alert system kind of went off, and we thought, well, we better put in some early warning system to see whether it's getting close or maybe into Switzerland as well. And we focused all our surveillance and the trapping in the south of Switzerland, assuming that would
that's
be...
That's where it would come from.
Exactly, because the spread was coming from south to north. But now actually the cases that occurred in Switzerland recently, they were all in the north. So that's completely opposite to what we expected. So I guess that would support the theory that there must have been an incursion somehow into Northern Europe. And because of the presence of the vectors there, it spread.
You've already mentioned the early warning systems. You seem to be an expert in the use of so-called sentinel systems to basically detect the introduction of a disease into a geographic area. Can you explain to our listeners what these sentinel systems actually are, what this means for a layman actually, and how they can be used both in the surveillance of first introduction of diseases and whether they also possibly would make sense in trying to monitor how a disease spreads, how a disease developed once it has become endemic potentially within a geographical area?
Well, sentinel systems is a specific type of surveillance system that is trying to use the available resources as effectively as possible. And so that means that you look at a limited number of farms, for example, in the case of sentinel farms. It could also be a limited number of veterinary practices if you wanted to use with sentinel practices. And work very closely with these sentinel units and follow them over time to see whether whatever you're looking for is actually occurring on these sites. So in the case of blue tongue, what we did in Switzerland, we had sentinel farms. And these sentinel farms, they were selected such that they would be high-risk farms, meaning that there would be a very high probability of blue tongue affecting animals on these farms if there had been an incursion into Switzerland. So in order to identify these high-risk units, you need to understand the biology of the disease of concern. So in case of blue tongue, we were looking at climatic factors and also hosts that are present, susceptible hosts such as cattle are quite attractive to these Culicoides midges. So this type of risk factors you use to identify these sentinel units. And then obviously you need to have cooperative farmers on these farms, because it's a kind of a prospective thing. So you go, then went back repeatedly. We did midge trapping on these farms, but also serology of the cattle on these farms to see whether they seroconverted over time. So they have been involved in this over many years. And so that is a way how we used sentinel farms in the case of blue tongue in Switzerland to see whether there had been an incursion or not. They can also be used in the context when you have an endemic situation, but for example, there is seasonality as it can occur for vector-borne diseases. And I know that sentinel farms are being used in Australia for Bluetongue in the regions where they have seasonal occurrence of Bluetongue. And how the information is then used is to determine the exact time of reoccurrence of the disease in order to introduce control strategies at the right moment.
So that would mean in Australia, for example, with regards to Bluetongue disease, based on results from these sentinel herds, the veterinary authorities would decide whether, for example, veterinary authorities would have to inflict transport bans onto the farming community, for example, or possibly start vaccinating against Bluetongue?
Correct. Whatever the appropriate control measures, they could be based on the outcome of the sentinel surveillance.
How intensive is this sentinel system? How densely do you have to spread these sentinel farms across a geographical area? What kind of factors play a role in determining this?
I think the emphasis in the sentinel system is more on quality of data collected rather than quantity. So what you're trying to do is to identify units that are representative of a region and that give you enough confidence that you would detect the incursion in that region through that number of farms or units that you have if it did occur. So it has to do with the transmission dynamics of a disease as well. If it's spreading very quickly, you probably have fewer units, while when it's spreading more slowly, you maybe have to have more in order
to
be
a better resolution.
Exactly, because it's all about early warning and rapid control.
The other question I was wanting to ask you is, how quickly do you actually expect Bluetongue virus to spread within the UK, based on the fact that there is a vector involved in it and possibly transport might be involved as well? But what is the more important factor in the spread of Bluetongue disease, which we will be able to stop in the future, but we probably have to brace ourselves, and that's why we need to understand these factors?
I guess the challenge is that there are these different transmission pathways. You not only can spread the virus by moving around infected animals, but also have the transmission pathway via the vector that is much more difficult
to control.
So to make a specific prediction, if you like, about the speed of transmission, this is very difficult to do because it's a very multifactorial event and a lot of factors impact, for example, on the Mitch activity. Temperature, humidity, things like that will affect the activity of the vector, but also the number of vectors that are present, how rapidly they can replicate, and that will all add to the effectiveness of transmission over a distance. Now, the midges are very small, so out of their own, let's say,
capacity,
they cannot fly very far. But obviously, because they are so small, they can be carried on wind and air streams. So that depends a lot. The effectiveness of windborne transmission depends a lot on other factors such as
geography and climate,
and also vegetation. For example, transmission over a big lake or the sea is much more effective, long-distance transmission,
rather than woods in between,
exactly, because it kind of gets filtered out. So there's a lot of factors.
A lot of factors which have to be taken into
account. Yeah, and then now with the change of season, obviously, the Mitch activity is going down rapidly, so that also slows the spread down a lot. So I guess it's very hard to actually tell how fast it's going to go, but assuming good conditions for Mitch activity, the spread can be quite fast. And there have been some estimations done in Northern Europe how fast per week, and it was several kilometers that they estimated it could travel per week. That's based on the analysis of the case data from last year, I believe. Now, this year was much more dynamic also in terms of the symptoms and the impact on animal health this year. So I assume that also the dynamics in terms of transmission would be different. But it's in a situation where you have movement control, it's largely then driven by the vector-borne transmission route.
But you have to say, given the fact of the, or given the speed of animal transport over longer distances nowadays, the transport by the vector would still be considerably slower, and possibly therefore restriction of animal transport in the case of an outbreak would still be a very, very important means of fighting the disease spread, right?
Absolutely, because the movement of viremic animals can potentially go much longer distances much more quickly. So it is important also in a situation where you kind of have a lag phase between the infection of the animal and the actual detection of the disease on a farm, where you have the risk of moving around infected animals that you have not identified. Movement control is very effective, and it is being used to limit the spread of the virus by that route.
And at the point when we hopefully in the future at some point will have a vaccine which will protect us from the serotype 8 here in Northern Europe, if we basically restrict animal transport, we would possibly be able to, for example, produce herds of animals which are actually immune in Scotland before the disease can actually get there via the midges, right?
Yes, and vaccination is also very attractive in order to allow to move around animals again. It is being used in southern Europe as a means to allow animal movement again out of infected zones, because you know that if you have a vaccinated animal and if you observe certain time intervals between the vaccination and the actual movement, it is quite safe to move around animals.
So that would be helpful to the farming community.
Very,
as well.
Very helpful.
You've mentioned vaccination as one means of fighting the disease already, but some people possibly might think that with a vector being involved in transmission, fighting the vector would be a means of combating disease. Do you have any evidence, or do you know of any evidence which would suggest that that is the case, and that that also would be feasible?
I think when we talk about vector control, there is basically two approaches or two issues to consider. One is the use of repellents that you use to discourage midges to bite the host. This is obviously, I mean, there's also an animal welfare issue there. If you have a lot of midges biting animals, that's also a welfare issue. The repellents, I'm not familiar with their effectiveness in detail, but I wouldn't think myself that that would be very effective in terms of actually preventing transmission. I think it would probably contribute to a reduced probability, but considering the high number of midges, thinking of the 70,000, it's unlikely that it will be very effective. Now, what is more promising would be to have a substance that can kill the larvae, so it can basically prevent the next generation of midges actually hatching. Now, in order to be able to do that, we need to have two things. We need to understand the biology of the vector. We need to know the breeding sites, basically, of these midges. Now, a lot of research, a very cumbersome research, again, has been conducted on this already, and not on all the species of culicoides that have been related to blue tongue outbreaks, but it seems to be very, very difficult to actually identify these breeding sites. I know some groups in southern France, they spend a lot of time actually sifting through soil of infected farms, trying to find the eggs and the larvae, and it's very frustrating work, I think, and the breakthrough is not there yet. So we would need to know the breeding sites, and then also we would have to have a substance that's actually able to kill off the larvae. So far, from what I know, is that at the moment we do not have substances that have been tested for their efficacy against culicoides larvae. And because the industry will only investigate this avenue if there is a market, there are no licensed products or no products that have a documented effectiveness as larvicides for corticoids at the moment.
So most likely the interest in the industry will increase at the moment, but it will unfortunately take time for them to come up with appropriate.
Yeah, I would speculate once we have the breeding sites, that would be there would be an interest, and hopefully there would be a market as well. At the same time, you must consider the environmental issues as well. So whatever substance.
Yeah, insecticides are not exactly easy compounds. No. Release into the environment.
Exactly. So and also the impact of insecticides on other insects. So it would have to be a substance that's quite specific.
Yeah, which has no effect on bees, for example.
Yeah, or if the breeding sites were kind of unique.
Very distinct, which that would make treatment
that would
much
make
easier.
It easier. So I guess a key requirement would be that you would have to know exactly where to apply it and when to apply it in order to avoid any side effects that you don't want.
Well, now that you've given us such a great insight into the work you've done in Switzerland before and also given us such a great insight into why the veterinary authorities are actually taking the measures that they are taking at the moment, can you tell us a little bit more about what type of work you're actually hoping to do at the Royal Veterinary College, because you've only joined the college about 6 months ago, and how you will be involved in the way that blue tongue will be fought in the United Kingdom in the future.
Now, my key area of interest is the design of surveillance systems and making sure that the methods we use for surveillance are not only effective but also cost efficient.
Mm-hmm.
So from my work in Switzerland, we developed some methods that help us compare different types of surveillance systems. For example, using sentinel surveillance and compare the effectiveness and the cost of this surveillance to a more passive case reporting type surveillance. Or, for example, in blue tongue, you could also do serological surveillance to compare different types of surveillance approaches and designs to make sure that the specific goals, for example, in the case of blue tongue, early warning, can be achieved.
And in the most cost-effective way.
Exactly. So I would like to continue working on that, not only for blue tongue, because these approaches can be
applicable all.
Yeah, they can be applied to whatever, you know, the pathogen of interest. They can even be used in food safety, looking for antimicrobial resistant bacteria, for example, and other foodborne pathogens. So it's really the introduction of the risk analysis concepts in the design of surveillance programs, and to make sure we're using all available knowledge to be as targeted as possible and to really use the resources where we can have most impact.
Well, I hope that objective of your work will actually turn into reality, and thank you for joining us again today to give us such a great insight on your work on blue tongue.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
That's it from us for today at the RBC podcast, and this episode marks the end of our series of podcasts on blue tongue. But please join us again in 2 weeks to find out more about how scientists and clinicians in the UK's largest and oldest veterinary school are pushing the frontiers of veterinary medicine and science. As always, the next episode will be available from the RBC webpage, but if you want to make sure not to miss any episodes in the future, please subscribe to the RBC podcast on iTunes. Goodbye.